Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Are you happy?
Happy Halloween, by the way.
Do you know what true happiness feels like for you? If not, do you know how to uncover happiness in your day-to-day life? Depression, stress, and despair in the U.S. is rising, not diminishing, and our country ranks 23rd on a list of the happiest countries, even with our comparative wealth and freedom. Something appears to be amiss in our ability to experience happiness. My guest today says you and I can develop the habit of experiencing happiness in our lives, and that's what I'm discussing with Thomas Bean, author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness. Welcome to Full Power Living. It's the only show on international media that regularly works to transform our world by exploring the power and importance of human emotions. I'm your host, Eileen Dillon, and I invite you to join our conversation today. You can do this in two ways, either on chats, one on blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living, and the other on emotionalpro.com on the radio show page. And we also have a toll-free number, 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570, and we'll put that up on the chats as well. Thomas Bean, PhD, is a psychologist in private practice in Albuquerque, New Mexico. He's a leader in the field of mindful psychology, and his URL, in fact, is mindfulpsychology.com. He conducts workshops on mindfulness and meditation. He's the author of numerous scientific articles and book chapters on spirituality and addiction. His other books include Mindful Recovery, Finding the Center Within, and Mindful Therapy. He's also co-editor of Mindfulness and the Therapeutic Relationship. Thomas Bean, it's a pleasure to welcome you to Full Power Living.
Thank you so much.
So the basic question we need to ask is, what exactly is happiness?
That is the question. There are those among people who practice Buddhism who argue that we should let go of the term of happiness because the pursuit of happiness can drive us crazy. But I can understand that, but I think maybe it's better to retain the term, but just understand it more deeply to heal the word happiness so that it can be used as an instrument of healing, in a phrase of the theologian Paul Tillich. And I think real happiness, we tend to think of happiness as acquisition of circumstances and things that will make us happy, but a deeper understanding of happiness that is evident in the Buddha's teaching and elsewhere, solid happiness is based more on contentment, on stopping and being able to appreciate what is already there, what you already have.
And so our idea of seeking happiness isn't really necessary. Now, you examine happiness and how to get there and what's in the way really very thoroughly in your book. And there are a couple of things I wanted to just mention about it. You talk about, for example, in the book, looking at a billboard that shows some people being happy, and the message really is that happiness comes from outside of us and that it involves looking a certain way, driving a certain car, whatever. But that in reality, happiness doesn't come from outside of us, and we can be happy right now, whatever the circumstances we're in. Can you talk about that?
Yes. One researcher on happiness, looking at all of the research, estimates that circumstances are only 10% of what makes us happy, and another 40% is pretty much up to us. The rest is genetics. So we can do an awful lot to make ourselves happier. And it's this training ourselves to come back to the present moment, to not get lost in our worries about the future or our reprocessing, rehashing the past. We can plan for the future. We can contemplate the past, of course, but we don't want to get swept away by those things so that we're, as we so often do, we're losing what's good and positive and nurturing and healing that's available to us right now.
Mm-hmm. In your book, The Buddha's Way of Happiness, you're also saying that we can teach ourselves to pay attention to things that really allow us to experience happiness every day. And you also identify the Buddhist teachings as a kind of ancient psychology, and then talk about some of the things that he offers in his, quote, psychology that can help us not really find happiness, but it's more like an uncovering.
Yeah, and that changes everything, I think. From the Buddhist point of view, we are already all Buddhas, and so we all have this ability to be peaceful, to be happy, and to be kind, but there's a lot of stuff that gets in the way, a lot of layers that get in the way. And those things mostly have to do with seeking pleasure. We have a pleasant experience and we enjoy it. We should enjoy it. But then we end up seeking more and more of that. That's kind of like trying to quench your thirst with salt water. The more you drink, the more you want. And then having unpleasant experiences and really distorting our lives and our energy in order to try to avoid all unpleasantness, which can never really be done. So those two factors, seeking pleasant experiences and trying so hard to avoid unpleasant experiences, are the things that really prevent us from being able to be here, be now, be open and accepting of what's going on now. And quite a lot of that is going to be positive.
It's been my learning over the years. I've been working as a transpersonally oriented therapist for 41 years now. It's been my learning that the only place we have power is in the present. And so it strikes me that when we're seeking pleasure, we're going for something in the future, and when we're trying to avoid unpleasantness, we're usually focused on what's happened to us in the past. So in addition to not being happy, we're also robbing ourselves of power, would you say? Personal power?
I agree with that, absolutely. This is the time that we can be alive, and we can't be alive in some future time. If you're drinking a glass of water, you can only enjoy it right now, and you have the power to open yourself and see that that's actually a pretty extraordinary thing that's going on, even something as simple as drinking a glass of water. There's an Arab saying that says you can't ride the camel that hasn't arrived yet, and you can't ride the camel that has already gone. It's the same idea, and we find this in many cultures.
Wow. So there are some other things that we allow to get in our way, and this is only a partial list of what you have. I'll mention some of them, and maybe we can look at them. One is judgment. Another is trying to be perfect. Third is making happiness a goal. Fourth is misperceptions about how the world really is. And then there's something you call habit energy. And then there's emotions. So I want to talk about emotions in our next section. But which of those do we most need to know about, or can you run through all of them?
We could touch on all of those. And I think probably the basis of all of those has to do with the deepest one in that list has to do with wrong perceptions of the world. And in the Buddha's insights, he has some profound and unique things to offer about how we look at the world and what is wrong with the way we look at the world and how that makes us suffer. And that when we see things from a different angle, we can be much happier.
The ultimate piece of that is that we see ourselves as separate from everybody and everything else, and therefore we get all alone and we feel alienated and we feel like things are just happening to us and we're not understood, etc. When in fact, as he points out and so many other thinkers also, and people are coming more to this awareness now, we're really interconnected. We're connected with everything and everybody. Is that the misperception, the primary misperception there?
That's one. And the related one is, which is normally spoken about first, is the reality of impermanence, that everything is changing all the time, not just, you know, when we are born or when we die, but birth and death are going on in every moment of our experience. In the past second, millions of red blood cells died in each of us who are living beings, and millions were born in us. So that's actually going on all the time. And it's an insight that around the time of the Buddha, Confucius had in China and Heraclitus had among the Greek philosophers, that everything is changing. Now, that might seem like an obvious thing to say, but if everything is changing every moment, what then are we really? And what are the things around us? We're really a process of change that's unfolding. And when we try to grasp onto things and people, or even onto ourselves and our own experiences, we're trying to grasp this tiny cross-section of this in time of this unfolding process that is essentially infinite and marvelous. But when we're trying to hold on to that, we're going to suffer. And so looked at from the perspective of time, we can say that the way that we look at things is as if everything were permanent and that we can hold on to them, when everything is really evanescent, more like soap bubbles, and trying to grasp onto them doesn't work and can lead to short-term happiness but not long-term satisfaction. And the same concept really from the other side is what you were talking about, which is the Buddha's idea of anatta, or no self, which is that if we're changing all the time and we're really more like a process, then there's no homunculus, there's no little guy within us that is the real self or something like that. We are this process of change and unfolding. And that can be a little frightening to consider at first, because we have the perception of being a self, of being separate. But as you say, we're really interconnected. We're 70% water. So when you look at a cloud, you know, we should feel a kinship with the cloud. When we look at a stream or a river or an ocean, we need to feel that we're a kinship with, we're at one with that, we're connected with that. And for that reason also, it doesn't make any sense to go on polluting the streams, because we are the streams. We are the clouds. So we're so profoundly interconnected that our happiness and happiness of other things and other beings around us cannot really be separated. And those two fundamental aspects, it's really the same thing. It's like one side of the coin is impermanence and the other side is no self. And they're really the same thing, one considered from the aspect of space and one considered from the aspect of time. But they really belong together. And if you if you see into those with total depth and clarity, which is a matter of some deep training to be able to do that, then they are the equivalent of nirvana. When you see that everything is impermanent and changing and that you are connected and not separate from everything, and you let go of this idea that you are an individual being with a limited lifespan and so on, then you enter a state of unshakable happiness and peace.
Well, but let me be devil's advocate here for a minute.
Please
so
do.
Many people are interested in safety or security. And what you've just talked about, I mean, how can a person, happiness, to be happy, don't we have to have some level of security or safety or something? And how in the world can you feel safe and secure if you're a flow and you're impermanent?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's exactly the way we normally look at things. I was teaching one time in Toronto, and a woman came up to me during the break and said, when we're talking about no self, she said, "I feel you're taking something away from me." And I said, "Well, I can't really take anything away from you that is not really there, or at least not really there in the way you think it is. So, so don't worry about that." But because of what you're saying, and there's certain practical realities we can discuss there, you know, that we obviously have to have some level of physical security, of protection from the elements, food and clothing and shelter and so on, or we're going to be pretty miserable, then that's for sure, and probably not able to do the work of transformation that I'm talking about. But that this is exactly the thing, that we tend to have the feeling that we can be more secure by grasping, and that will make us happier. But actually, the more you let go, the happier you become. So if you let go a little bit, so that you're more open to the experience of what's going on here and now, you can have a little bit of happiness. And if you let go more than that, you can have some more happiness. And if you let go entirely, you can have total happiness, which is which Buddhists call nirvana, or a Christian might call living in the kingdom of heaven.
When you're saying let go, the question arises in my mind, let go into what?
Well, let go into what is. And to see that what is not the way we normally think of things, that the chair I'm sitting on, for example, is actually a temporary manifestation. And the more I can see that, the less upset I'll be if it breaks. And when it breaks. That's what you are in, and it's to let go into marvelous becoming, wondrous becoming. And it does seem to be a little scary at first. It does feel like you're losing something at times, but all you're losing is a kind of delusion anyway.
Mm-hmm. I remember back in the 70s, people did these trust walks and allowing yourself to fall backwards into the arms of a lot of people. So it strikes me it's sort of like that. We have to turn loose and trust that there is a canopy or a support there. And what you're saying is that there definitely is a support. And the more you can turn loose and fall backwards, figuratively speaking, the more you'll find it.
Yes, and one doesn't lose one's common sense by adopting this perspective. It's still advisable to wear a seatbelt when you're driving, or to wear a helmet on your head if you're on a bicycle or a motorcycle. You don't have to give up common sense kinds of things to do this, but there is something that deeper that supports us, and the cultivation of safety is an extremely important basis for all kind of transformation. For Buddhists, you cultivate safety by taking refuge. And you take refuge in the Buddha. That means you think maybe he knows what he's talking about. And as you learn more about it, you come to see that perhaps more and more deeply and rely on it more deeply. In the Dharma, which is the teaching itself, and in the Sangha, which is the community of people who practice with you. And for me, Sangha isn't just Buddha. Sangha is all the people that are taking a deeper perspective on life and seeking to live more deeply, more kindly, with more peace and happiness.
Mm-hmm.
You know, in other faith paths, there's different ways of cultivating safety. And I think that's the universal aspect. I know of a physicist, for example, who feels safe in the world because he understands what's around him from the basis of physics and all the mathematical equations that apply to those things. And that gives him a sense of safety so that he can experience the world with safety. Many ways of doing that, but it is essential that we have some sense of safety.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for clarifying that. We're up to our first break. You're listening to Full Power Living, and my guest today is Thomas Bean, who's a psychologist and author of The Buddha's Way of Happiness. We're going to be discovering how to move undesired emotion out of our way so that we can strengthen our connection to happiness when we return. Stay tuned.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
How would you parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student? As a host for an exchange student, you'd have five main jobs to do. Those are the same five jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of the Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download the Exchange Student Model for Parenting today. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. I invite you, while you're on the Emotional Pro website, to register to receive our twice-weekly newsletter, which gives you information about our upcoming shows and remind you that if you miss any of our live Full Power Living broadcasts or you want to share them with friends and family, they are archived for a period of time both on Blog Talk Radio and on Full Power Living. And you also can subscribe to Full Power Living on iTunes. Remember to chat with us and also to give us a call on either of the sites on which you're listening. So next week, my guest is Camille Minichino. She's a physicist and an author, and she's written a charming little book called How to Live with an Engineer. Most people I know who are in relationships with engineers experience a lot of vexation in living with them, and she suggests it's because we don't understand how their brains work. My dad was an engineer, so I really want to get this. Join me next Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific time for this show. Today, the Buddha's Way of Happiness. And Tom, Buddha was a privileged young man, and he had a burning desire to understand. And so he took himself down to bare bones, getting to that no self. And really, he developed an understanding about paying attention to things, as much as I can figure, about focusing in the now, about being mindful. What's the basis, as you understand it, of his way of looking at the world?
Well, you touched on his journey, which Joseph Campbell saw as an example of the hero's journey, leaving and undergoing certain trials, and he left his privileged home, and he was a very sensitive human being, obviously, and a very intelligent and talented one. But when he encountered human suffering in the form of illness, old age, and death, he had been so protected, is the legend, that these shocked him to the core, and he wanted to figure this out. He wanted to find a way out of suffering. And so his journey involved, first of all, a deep training in meditation. And since he was very good at that kind of thing, he quickly penetrated to deep states of meditative bliss. But he found that that too was only temporary, because when he came out of bliss, illness and old age and suffering and everything else that causes human misery were still there. And so that wasn't an adequate answer. And then he took the path that you described of extreme asceticism. It's said that at points in time he was living on one grain of rice a day, and that when he went to touch his stomach, he could touch his backbone.
Wow.
So very, very, very extreme. And he realized through the help of a girl who offered him a little bit of rice milk one day, and he finally had some energy again that would allow him to actually practice, he realized that that too was a dead end. You couldn't get anywhere by trying to destroy yourself. And so he developed what he called the middle way, which has philosophical and practice aspects. But just to mention the practice aspects, it's the middle way between extreme asceticism and extreme hedonism, or the quest for unending pleasure. Both of those he sees as dead ends.
Mm-hmm.
So To understand that journey, then, you can begin to see that he understood that meditation was important. He didn't devalue that at all. And achieving those kinds of states was a wonderful and helpful experience, but it wasn't the ultimate answer. And so the way I see the teaching of the Buddha, that one of the things that's really unique about it is exactly this idea of mindfulness. Mindfulness means that the most important moment of your meditation is the moment when you're leaving your cushion. It's the moment when you're transitioning from a meditative kind of state into daily life. And that's the moment when you need to find a way to bring some of the peace that is based on observing what's going on, watching it, being aware and open, to bring that same attitude with you into daily life. And that is the practice of mindfulness, which could also be described as the practice of happiness itself, I think. So that's the key difference between some practices and the practices that the Buddha offered, and that's being aware moment by moment, being open to the experience, accepting, perhaps a better word is allowing. People get confused by the word accepting. They think it means they have to like it or something. You don't have to like everything that's going on, but you have to allow it to unfold, because most of the stuff, a lot of the stuff that happens to us, we don't have direct influence over. We can't control.
Mm-hmm. That's certainly so. But human beings react emotionally to what happens in their life, and I think my experience, my observation is that this is what causes us to suffer. And also from reading your book, it seems to me that happiness is not available when we're reacting emotionally. And since you're both a psychologist and a spiritual person, talk to me a little bit about how we can move beyond emotions and why we want to.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're certainly absolutely right that emotion can be the cause of a lot of suffering for us. I think one thing to understand is that, and one of the things that happens in good psychotherapy is that a person will feel deeply understood by the therapist. And when we feel deeply understood, our emotions can calm down. So if you have a therapist like that, or even if you have a friend or family member who will just be present with you and understand your experience, this is not the person who offers ready advice and solutions, because normally what happens when people give us advice is we feel even less understood. But when we feel deeply understood, the emotion centers of the brain that are called the limbic system can calm down, and finally we can begin to see things more calmly and clearly and begin to figure out our way through our difficulties. So that's the first thing I would say. But mindfulness is also a way for us to bring understanding to ourselves. As we look deeply into what's happening with us and what we're feeling, even if it's strong feelings of sadness or despair or anger or frustration, we can train ourselves to become stronger in the practice of mindfulness. And we learn to embrace these difficult emotions with our mindfulness, and to allow ourselves to experience them. Mm-hmm. This is the middle way between trying to suppress our experience, which whatever we would suppress, we get more of. So if you're trying to avoid anxiety, you're going to end up being more anxious than ever. If you're trying to avoid sadness, sadness will increase. So we're not suppressing, and you're also not feeding it, because quite often, say we get sad, we do things that will make it worse, like taking drugs or alcohol or playing sad music or cutting ourselves off from people who might help us and from experiences that might help us. So we're not feeding it and we're not suppressing it. We're simply practicing the art of what's sometimes called mere recognition, to just be present to what exactly is. And as we do that, gradually that emotion, that strong emotion, can calm down. And as we transform at that again and again, it affects the base of our consciousness, so that our tendency to get angry or to experience sadness and despair actually diminishes over time.
Mm-hmm.
So
yes.
The first way is about learning learning to take care of the negative emotions when they manifest, and that ultimately affects our tendency in that direction. But if I might also say, the second way is also very useful, and that is to practice awareness of what is positive and nurturing. We know in psychology studies that writing in a notebook a few times a week things that you're grateful for has significant mood effects, something as simple as that. But in mindfulness practice, that helps mindfulness practice, but in mindfulness practice, you can learn to be aware moment by moment of the things around you that are positive. And so as I'm sitting at my desk here, I'm also aware of how blue the sky is. And many of us can go for years without deeply appreciating the blueness of the sky or the yellowing of the leaves that I see out my window right now. And if we really open to those experiences and just this, instead of seeing them in a ho-hum kind of way, but really seeing these things as the miracles of life that they really are, we make ourselves more resilient to the difficult emotions and can move the whole tone of our psyche up some notches in the direction of being more positive and happy. Mm-hmm. I don't think we can escape emotions, or maybe a perfect Buddha can, but that's a long way off for most of us. But I think we can learn to work with them. And as we learn to work with them in these ways, their grip on us loosens, and we see that they're also impermanent and not self, and something that's passing and ultimately insubstantial.
We have the capacity to be responding in the moment. I'm just remembering Friday or Saturday, my son came by with my 8-year-old granddaughter, and she had accompanied him to a conference that day. She'd had a good day, but she wasn't in my home more than 1.5 minutes before she was laughing with glee about how the puppy was responding to her, how my puppy was responding to her. And it really struck me, you know, her ability to be so present and take such delight in what was happening right then was right on her sleeve. And I really, you know, I was thinking about that as I was reading your book, because what we do is we, like, cover everything over and lose that ability. But you make the point, you know, there's no reason to go looking for happiness. It's right there. It's there all the time, that same happiness, is it not?
Isn't that great to see a child just enjoying a puppy like that? And they remind us what's possible. And I think this is why Jesus taught, too, that unless you turn and become as a little child, you can't enter the kingdom of heaven. Because when children see things, they really see things. And when we see things, we tend to just see an affirmation of what we already believe. So we have a concept of what a puppy is like, and we look at the puppy and we see, oh yes, that's a puppy, and puppies act this way or that way. And so it becomes a ho-hum experience. But if you can see it with wonder and delight, and let children teach you to be able to do that again, to see a puppy is an amazing experience. and it can foster our happiness. And it's something quite different, you know, from having to get a new car or a better relationship or whatever it is, or a degree or whatever you're pining for. Those things can all be good, and we can and should enjoy those things. But just because that may be absent right now, it doesn't mean that there aren't many things around us to enjoy, many wonders.
That's certainly true. Yes, thank you. Those are really great comments. I didn't expect to get a puppy. One of the things that I'm thinking about as you're talking is that with the dog I have now and the one that I lost at the end of last year, when I did open myself to them, I discovered that each of the dogs is communicating with me, and I can understand what they're communicating, whereas when I don't open, I am sitting around puzzled, you know, why are you sitting there, what's going on with you, whereas now it would be, oh, you're ready to go out, or oh, you're thirsty. I get those things now. Is that more like, I'm thinking about mindfulness. Not everybody's familiar with mindfulness, but it's about being totally present, and when you're totally present, you're going to pick up things that you might not otherwise pick up. Is that true?
Absolutely so. All it takes in what you're describing, right, is to actually pause and open and ask yourself what's going on with your dog. And mm-hmm. dogs, as mammals, you know, have, like us, have mirror neurons so that they can be, and as pack animals in particular, they're used to being very attuned to the leader of the pack, which is what we become, the alpha male or alpha female. And so we can do the same thing back, and we can, if we just pause and open, we can often understand a lot more of what they're telling us than we might think. And this goes on. There's a type of meditation called metta meditation with two T's.
Mm-hmm.
That's loving kindness meditation. And people who practice that deeply have shown a capacity to be acutely aware of subtle changes in facial expression of the person they're with, and in a much clearer way than the average person would be. And so we can... It might be a psychic connection, or I don't want to deny that. That could be going on too, but it also could be that we're when we're deeply attuned and open, and have this attitude of kindness, which is connected with mindfulness, that we read more closely what's going on with other beings around us, and we catch these subtle clues that might even be going on below the level of our conscious awareness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I might mention that in the last year, I have, well, it's a little bit longer than that, but I have also encouraged three cats who were, like, living under houses and such to move in with us, even with a puppy.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not just dogs, it's, you know, and one of the cats, which was interesting, I'm taking a little bit of a side step here, but it's fascinating to me. All I did with him was say, you know, someday I want to be able to scratch you under your chin. And a couple days later, he allowed me to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, well, you know, we don't have a dog right now, so you could come upstairs. And a day later, he was upstairs. Things that he wouldn't do otherwise.
Mm-hmm.
But I just communicated with him, and he accepted my invitation, if you will. And,
mm-hmm.
and so it strikes me as you're talking that looking for happiness, or not looking for happiness, let me take that back, opening ourselves to happiness,
yeah,
in the way that you describe in the Buddhist way of happiness actually makes our lives more richer and we feel more connected and we're kind because it feels good to us, not because we have an idea we're supposed to be.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And also, your story illustrates something that is outside of mindfulness, but that we can have the ability to put an intention out there, and that can be very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And it can, because everything is connected, that can change everything around us. Mind is situation, and situation is mind. So when we change our minds about something, we also change the situation. And when we change the situation, it also changes our mind. So you put that intention out there, and it was powerful enough that it seems to have gotten through. And intention is very important in the Buddhist teaching as well, because it's intention that determines our karma.
Mm-hmm.
If you step on a bug inadvertently, no negative karma accrues to you. But if you intentionally step on that bug, there might be some negative karma that accrues to you. So
mm-hmm.
it's really about the intention and having positive intentions. And you know, how about just having the intention to be happier?
As a therapist now, I work with that concept because a lot of times, especially if people are hooked in codependently with others,
mm-hmm.
they either hold themselves or somebody else holds them responsible for the other person getting hurt. And I usually take them through and say, was it your intention to hurt this person?
Oh,
and if they really did not intend and were kind of surprised even that it happened, then I say, well, it's not your issue then. It's the other person's issue.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's pretty tricky, I think, the whole dependency and codependency thing, because
mm-hmm.
what you're saying is true, and a Buddhist might talk about it as not being responsible for other people's karma.
Ah.
They have their own path and the consequences of their actions and the consequences of their habits that are being enacted are theirs, and you can't take those on. No one else can take them on. They have to go through them themselves, and often trying to lecture someone or advise someone makes them even more recalcitrant and reactive. You know, the wife of the alcoholic who says, "You got to stop drinking," and then he gets like, "Oh, I'm going to show you."
Yeah, right.
And so these advice and trying to change others can backfire on us, and most of the time does. So I think intention can be very important. The other side of that which the East tends to bring out is that this aspect of being deeply connected with others. And so if you come home from work to your spouse or partner and you've had a bad day at work and you're feeling unhappy and miserable, well, there's no way that's not going to affect your spouse or partner. It's going to bleed over. And so that's coming at it from the other side, and it suggests that one of the reasons that we work to be happier people and to, you know, transform our own garbage, our own neuroses, is that it also is for the benefit of those around us. And as we become happier, more clear, more wise, that will affect other people as well in a positive way.
So I want to look a little bit, you've mentioned this before, but I've long had a difficulty with the concept that we suffer, and yet we human beings, and yet the concept of suffering, which, if I say it right, dukkha, is a cornerstone of Buddhist teachings, and it helps us. It's like if we didn't have suffering, we wouldn't search for non-suffering or for
right.
enlightenment or for happiness. Is that the way it works?
Well, that's right at the heart of it. And remembering that the Buddha's whole quest was to find out about suffering and learn how to become free of suffering. So the idea is this. Well, today in the positive psychology movement, we might approach it from the other side, and that was part of my point in writing a book about happiness as well. We approach from the other side, from the side of happiness or well-being and what that's about. But in the context of ancient India, Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, was approaching it from the side of suffering. It's kind of like, do you write a book about happiness or do you write a book about depression? He was writing the book about depression.
Uh-huh.
And his truth is that he called dukkha or suffering, or the best translation for it, I think, is unsatisfactoriness.
Mm-hmm.
Unsatisfactoriness. Because even when you get that wonderful new car and you drive it home, the minute you drive it off the lot, it's no longer a new car. It's a used car. It's a trade-in. And you start to worry about it getting a nick or a ding or something like that. It's already changing and impermanent. So looking into suffering teaches us something about how to go in the direction of non-suffering or well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you look into the nature of our suffering, you realize that you're never going to find ultimate satisfaction from things like that.
Mm-hmm.
Because they're always changing. But you can find satisfaction if you flow with things as they're changing and appreciate what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's kind of like walking south by keeping the North Star at your back. You have to know what causes your suffering, and then when you see what causes your suffering, then you'll know what will free you from it.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Many years ago, I attended a lecture by an Indian yogi named Kaushik, Kaushik, and he was talking with us about facing fact. And I thought of that concept as I was reading your words about dealing with emotions, for example. Facing fact, he said, is looking at things squarely for what they really are and not, you know, living with what somebody else has told us or what we wish they would be. And I'm impressed. I think this concept is involved in your examination in the Buddha's Way of Happiness of death, because to really appreciate life, we also need not to be walking around being afraid of death or being distracted by death. At the same time, we need to accept that the impermanence, as you've been talking about today.
Exactly. Yes. If we're not able to look at things square in the face as they really are, it distorts everything. And it may be distorting things in an unconscious way, but there's always going to be this background of anxiety and fear unless we acknowledge what really is going on. So Buddhists have meditation practices where they look at death squarely. Even, especially in the past, but still some do now, meditating on how the body decomposes and everything else.
Mm-hmm.
But to be able to look at it, because when you can look at that and you get accustomed to that, what are you afraid of?
And exactly.
That's the ultimate gift then. You have the gift of non-fear. And when you have the gift of non-fear, that contributes immensely to your ability to open and allow and experience life as it's going on right now. There was a story about one Buddhist teacher, a meditation teacher, Sylvia Boorstein is her name.
Oh, yes, I know her.
And she talked about traveling somewhere, and she and other noted meditation teachers were meeting with someone, and it was that they were all noted meditation teachers, but there was this man from Japan who was sort of the spiritual heavyweight of the group. And Sylvia says that she knew that he just had a bout with cancer. And she said that she had some fear about asking about that because she was afraid that, you know, what she would hear some garbage about, well, you know, it was a wonderful experience because it made me appreciate, you know, something like that, you know. I learned from it, I grew from it, all of which has some truth to it. But when she asked him about it, he just said it was terrible. He said it was terrible. And when that could be just acknowledged in its raw form, she said you could feel everyone's tension in the group subsiding just because they were able to be present with the truth. And so I think it works like that. Suppression doesn't help. Denial doesn't help. It leaves a background of anxiety that bleeds over into all of our experiences.
Your website is mindfulpsychology.com, and you told me earlier that you wanted to tell people something about your website.
Yes, a couple of things, if I might. The website is mindfulpsychology.com. If you go there, you can, among other things, get a free download of Chapter 1 of the Buddha's Way of Happiness and see whether that's something that might speak to you. And then probably the best way to find it is going to be at Amazon or BarnesandNoble.com. And also would like to mention that I will be teaching my mindful living course here in Albuquerque at the University Continuing Education Department at Saturday, March 8th. That's UNM, University of New Mexico Continuing Education. And if you are up for some lovely travel, I'll be also teaching therapists my take on mindful therapy on April 5th and 6th in Florence, and on April 12th and 13th in Palermo in Italy. I'll be posting those things on the website also, and you can find out more about those things.
Nice is all I say. Nice. That sounds good. All right. Well, Tom, it's been absolute delight to talk with you and discover this approach for happiness. And I want to say that I have learned something about Buddhism along the way and had people talk to me about it, but I've never had the approach explained as clearly and as simply as I encountered it in your book, The Buddha's Way of Happiness. So I want to thank you for writing this book.
When you get a compliment, you know, sometimes they don't fit, but that one exactly fits my intention in writing the book, so thank you so much.
Wonderful. Wow, that's great. All right. And also thank you for being with us on Full Power Living today. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
So join me live next Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, that's noon Eastern Time, when Camille Minichino, a physicist and author, joins me for a lighter look at life when we discuss how to live with an engineer. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media is our producer. Thank you, Paul, for your attentions on this show and over the years. And for now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you to pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.